Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener Ireland at Hyundai.ie.
Good morning again. Damien O'Reilly here for Brendan once again today until 1 o'clock. You can text us on 51551. How are you this Sunday morning? Hope the weather is getting a little bit better where you are, and you can enjoy the Sunday afternoon. Lots to get through. Whether it's the weekend test for pub openings that have just happened, Micheál Martin's honeymoon week from hell, or Kanye West for president. We'll chat our way through these stories over the next couple of hours and what's in the papers as well. And we'll have a quick look at the front of the Sunday papers. We'll begin with the Irish Mail on Sunday, and it has a story. Varadkar has a final party in Farmley. He's addicted to the perks of office, says one Fine Gael insider. That's news that Taoiseach, you have to remember he's Taoiseach, no longer Taoiseach, he held a farewell party at the Stewart's Lodge in Farmley beside the Phoenix Park on Friday evening as members of his own party questioned his seeming addiction to the trappings of power, quote unquote. The Business Post has government to subsidise wages of newly hired workers under stimulus plan, coalition eager to reduce numbers on the pandemic unemployment payment. That's a story there by Michael Brennan. Moving on to the Sunday Times. The lead there is similar enough. Seasonal staff protected in new $1 billion stimulus. And along the side there, did China find clues to virus in 2013? The Irish Sunday Mirror has marijuana sensation. Health Minister says legalise weed. Donnelly admits he has smoked cannabis, and he says he is open on ways to decriminalise the drug. The Sunday World leads with gangland exclusive. Cartel Encro phone dealer busted, a story there in relation to gangland, which of course the Sunday World leads and does a lot of great work with every week. And finally, the Sunday Independent, a new plan to tackle crisis in housing, extra help for first time buyers, more social housing planned. Niamh Horan with that story there. She has an interview with Dara O'Brien. She says it's his first interview since being appointed minister, but I heard him here earlier this week on Radio 1, so it's his second interview, but first maybe in print. But that's in the Sunday Independent. My panel here this morning with me, Larry Donnelly, lecturer of law at NUI Galway and columnist with the journal.ie. Sheila Riley is head of digital at Iconic News, and John Boyle is the INTO secretary and former principal at St. Colum Kills Junior National School in Knocklyon. Welcome all. Thanks for joining us. So we've lots to get through. We're going to start with the pubs, which reopened last Monday. And Sheila, I know you're from a pub background, as I am as well. But the story on page three of the Sunday Business Post by Peter O'Dwyer reads, "Close the pubs that flout coronavirus rules," says Vintner's chief executive. "Authorities should be taking action on the small number of pubs that ignore the COVID-19 guidelines," says the boss of the pubs representative group. That's Pádraig Cribben, who represents the VFI, the Vintners Federation of Ireland, which are all the rural pubs. And then there's the LVA, the Licensed Vintners of Ireland, a bit like the teachers' unions. There's a few of them
on the go.
And Donal O'Keefe earlier this week was saying the same. Shut them down if there's anything. I'll come to you in a moment, guys. But first I want to go to Matthew O'Toole, who's a GP. And we've seen and heard a lot of Matthew over the last few months, because there are several pictures on social media this morning of crowds of people drinking in, not Longford City Centre, Sheila, but Dublin City Centre last night. And let's just say that it doesn't seem that there's much social distancing or wearing of masks. Now, you can't always go on, you know, three-dimensional photographs. But Matthew, good morning to you.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You were working last night, and you got a call from someone to tell you to go through the city, am I right?
Yeah, I was working with the ambulance service last night, and I finished it about 10 o'clock, and I was getting calls from colleagues, and I'm seeing it on social media. Just, they were saying that the town was mobbed last night, so I drove through Dublin City Centre on the way home, and the best way I could describe it, as it felt like All-Ireland football final night, and it felt like Dublin had won. That was the vibe in Dublin City last night. It was just completely rammed. There were guards everywhere, and they were doing their best, but it was just completely rammed. That was the only way that I could describe it.
And when you say rammed, like, was people like out and about walking, or were they drinking on the streets, or what did you see?
Yeah, I mean, it was a festival atmosphere. And I suppose what we're seeing now is that, you know, takeaway pints have become a new phenomenon now, one of the COVID phenomenon. So people were drinking on the streets. And as I said, all of the streets were literally just packed with people. And it was, you know, it was profoundly upsetting, to be honest. I mean, I came home from it last night and I really felt like it was a slap in the face to those that have broken their backs trying to keep the country working over the last 3 months. I really felt that way. And it was really anxiety inducing. Like, those on the front line have been psychologically traumatized by what they've experienced over the last 3 months. And just they're just not ready to face into it again. And after last night, I really think that we're weeks away from a second wave, you know, and my colleagues on the front line are just, they're just not ready for it psychologically.
Yeah, I see where the 57 headline on Clambassel Street in Dublin, they tweeted, like, this is not, you know, only nurses and doctors and people working on the front line have been working so hard that would be annoyed and have seen the damage that has been done. But obviously people in the industry and publicans that are waiting and bar staff to reopen in a couple of weeks' time, there was a number of tweets. I'll just read one. I think this may sum up the feeling in the industry from the 57 headline on Clambassel Street last night. I'm so disappointed by this. Exactly like Friday, it's only a few pubs that have decided that this is okay. Shame on them. The rest of us adhere to guidelines or remain closed, but we'll all be tarred with the same brush. Sheila, I was just thinking, stay with us there, Matthew, if you can. Well, let's go back to May when Leo Varadkar, then Taoiseach, announced the phased reopening of the country. Pubs were last in what was phase 5, which is now phase 4. And restaurants were in phase 4, which is now phase 3. And some gastro pubs said, hold on, we serve food. Why can't we open with the restaurants? Da-da-da-da-da. You know, come on, it's not fair. We should be able to do that. Do you think that NPHET were blindsided by that? Shouldn't they have been told, you can reopen? But no beer, no spirits. You can open like a restaurant, seat people down for an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes, let them have wine or water, and then you can open your bar part later. Wouldn't that have solved what we've been seeing this weekend and given us another 3 weeks?
Yeah, it would have solved some of it for sure, you'd imagine. But wouldn't another scenario should have been that, why were they allowed to open? They shouldn't have been allowed to open in the first place. Like, the €9 meal to me kind of smacks of really, to be honest, elitism. Not everybody can afford the €9 to go out. They just want to go out and have a few pints maybe on a Saturday night or whatever, which, you know, a lot of people do, and kind of that's their social outlet. So I've always kind of had an issue with that, with the the €9 aspect of it. I just think, why did that come in? It was just to appease that group, and that it shouldn't have actually happened. They should have just stuck to their guns. The pubs should have opened all together in July 20th and leave it at that. And what you have now is kind of the inevitable scenario, I suppose, in a way, where it's gotten a little bit out of control already. Sky News were leading with similar scenes kind of in London, you know, so it's not unique to us, if you like. But this is kind of inevitable. So now what are they going to do? Are they going to delay the opening of the rest of the pubs? And if they do that, how can you have a scenario where you have some places open and not others? How is that fair? Or are they going to actually roll back, maybe take a serious stance and say, listen, lads, this isn't working, we're just going to pull the plug on it?
But my point, though, you're saying the €9 for people that want to go out and have a few pints. If you want to go out and have your few pints and are worried, don't want to be spending the €9, wait until the 20th of July and go to a pub for pints.
I would agree with that, to be honest. Yeah. I don't see what the benefit of, you could have held on for the couple of weeks. Like, we know the temporary wage subsidy scheme was still going to be in place. We know the PUP, pandemic payment was still going to be in place until August anyway. So it wasn't a case that you were going to have a scenario where you were going to be moving people from the 350 pandemic payment down to 203 in that period. You weren't. So they easily could have held off for the couple of weeks, to be quite honest. It wouldn't have materially made a huge difference in the grand scheme of things.
But Larry Donnelly, is this more a reflection on us than on the bar staff and publicans that are doing their best?
I think it's a reflection on everybody, not just people in Ireland, but people around the world. One's heart breaks for Matthew and for frontline workers like him when you hear that. But Sheila, I think, used the key word. inevitable. Whether it's July 20th, whether it's August 10th, no matter what the date is, COVID is going to be here for a while. And it was inevitable that when places open, there is a certain cadre of people who are going to go out and go mad. That's the bottom line. I don't think there's any escaping it one way or another. All we can really do is hope and continue to say people should use their good sense. Some people will not, but hope and pray that the second wave doesn't hit as badly as I fear it might.
Yeah, the Business Post today, page 12, very interesting stuff here. Tomás Ryan from TCD, you know, and he's been arguing quite a lot in relation to this economy versus health issue, and health versus the economy is a false dichotomy. Mm. That's what he's saying. Danielle Barron has, her piece is headlined, "The COVID-19 Reality is Our Reality for This Year, Next Year and Maybe Beyond." John Boyle, I'll come back in, Sheila, then.
Yeah, I'm really concerned about what was happening in Dublin over the weekend and various cities throughout the world. I actually had the beautiful weekend in Ennis, County Clare and West Clare. And I was in a hotel bar on Friday night. I couldn't believe the efforts that the staff there had gone to make sure that everybody was going to be safe. Yes, I did have some food and first drink in 6 or 7 months nearly at this stage, and very much enjoyed the experience. Very different experience, but you know, I really feel for the people who put the effort into the national return to work protocol. That was designed to protect everybody going back into the workplace, and you know, I don't want to see anybody's livelihood jeopardised or their lives jeopardised because the pubs opened. And furthermore, obviously, it's a real kick in the teeth to all those public servants in the health sector who have gone in there and risked their lives to keep people safe.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to Matt in a moment there, but Sheila, you want to come back?
Yeah, I was just going to say about Tomás Ryan's piece. I thought it was very interesting because he makes the point, and this is really important, and I think we may be coming to this relation when we're talking to the teacher, about the teachers later. You know, the health and the economy, the health issues and the economy, they're not mutually exclusive. They are absolutely tied in together. And what they are coming up against is the organisations and organisational and logistical end of it. And that's the reality of it. This is the big challenge we have now, is the organisational and logistical challenge. Like, I was in the pub business for a number of years. My heart absolutely goes out to anybody trying to keep a business afloat at this stage. I can imagine. I cannot begin to imagine how extraordinarily difficult it is. It was extraordinarily difficult for a long period of time before this happened, and a lot of places have been clinging on by their absolute fingernails as it is.
It's the employees as well that have families and bills to pay as well. Matthew, just on that, where do you stand as somebody in the health service in relation to this argument? It's not an argument, but it is a dichotomy, as your colleague Tomás Ryan says. About reopening the economy, making the money, bringing in the taxes that actually pay for public service, and obviously making sure that everybody is healthy and flattening the curve and making sure hospitals are not overrun. What's your own view on that?
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, using pubs as an example, like, I'm not trying to be a killjoy here. Like, my own father is a publican who's been planning for the last 2 months to reopen his own bar in Galway. And the vast majority of pubs will be able to open safely. Like, I'm, you know, as keen as the rest of us to go and have a pint in my local. But the vast majority of pubs will do this safely. But it's the few that won't that will ruin it for the rest of us and the rest of the industry. So I completely agree with Tomás Ryan. I mean, we know that if you look at economies that have gone into recession, that has a profound negative impact on the health of society. We can open up the economy and we can do it safely. And again, using pubs as an example, you know, there are really good rules and criteria in place now. You know, my own local here in Ranelagh, you know, there are your signs everywhere. Everyone is washing their hands. It's not an enjoyable experience at the moment, but everyone is following the rules because they know they have to. But it's just really concerning when you see, you know, a small number of venues who just are flouting the rules completely. It's upsetting because it is going to damage the industry, because what will happen is pubs will close again as a result of this. And it will, as I said, inevitably lead to a second wave. So it's about doing it right, and it's about everybody following the rules, not allowing the few to break them.
Yeah, and I'd just be interested, before I let you go, Matthew, on your thoughts in relation to foreign travel. Like, Brendan himself mightn't be here today. He's still writing in the Sunday Indo. He has his piece, and just I don't know whether you agree with this. He kind of quips that no one will quite say. To your face when you come back from Portugal, but there will be pointed comments, squinting windows, and maybe some crossing over to the other side of the road. So we're going to have a summer of public shaming when it comes to people going out to support the local economy by having a meal or going for a pint, or going away on holidays.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, again, it's very simple in my mind. Like, what we're asking people to do is to sacrifice one summer holiday abroad this year and to put, you know, their country and their loved ones before themselves for once. That's all we're asking people to do. You know, this is a once in a lifetime event. And look, I mean, I think you'd be completely bananas, to put it mildly, to go on holidays abroad this year. I mean, the risks are huge. You know, we're seeing areas in Spain at the moment going into lockdown. I mean, the risks, what I'm saying to people at the moment, that you won't be able to travel because the region that you're flying to will be in lockdown, or the risk that you might be somewhere and that place may go into lockdown. Those risks are huge. So I think, you know, if there was one message I could get out, it's basically, you know, if we could put the country, our loved ones, and those in the front line before ourselves just this summer, and holiday at home. Think of the economy. I mean, you know, there are pubs and venues and hotels right across the country that need our support. And to just, as I said, to put the country before ourselves just for the summer of 2020.
Okay, I'll let you go there. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us with that anecdote with your own two eyes that you saw last night. Larry Donnelly, as an American and with relations living abroad, when you hear Matthew there with that plea, you hear Dr. Tony O'Hoolihan with the plea, stay at home, what's your reaction?
Well, it's very hard, but I think that's what has to be done. I mean, it's not easy for me. My father is 86. He's in a nursing home. He's very unwell. We don't know what the future holds for him, but I can't go see him, and that's heartbreaking for me. But we have to do what we have to do, and I think I agree with Matthew's assertion. I think if you do go abroad, I think it's crazy, to be quite frank. And I think the other point that's worth making is, in terms of the economy, I mean, there are a lot of dire predictions about what's going to happen in the wake of COVID. But on the flip side, if we all are at home and if we do support local businesses, if we do go around the country and spend our money, then I think there's a potential for a recovery. And I think that there's two prongs to it, both public health and the economy. They're not mutually exclusive.
Okay, before I move on, anybody else spot anything in the papers in relation to travel, masks, anything like that, John?
Yeah, this whole question about whether masks should be mandatory, there's a number of articles
Alan O'Keefe
in
has
relation
one.
To that, yeah. I suppose that's going to be a big issue for, in my sector, schools reopening, and whether or not the staff are going to be wearing masks. And it's very, very difficult to teach young children whilst wearing a mask, but at the same time, there's a lot of vulnerable people, both children with underlying health conditions, and indeed those who are caring for their intimate care needs. So we're working really hard with the Department of Education to make sure that's looked after.
How important, silly question in a way, but how important are facial expressions in a classroom?
They're so important. The wonder and awe of the classroom. And, you know, teachers are, I suppose, like actors in a sense, you know. Yeah. It's very difficult to act while you're wearing a mask. But we have to stay safe. So in some situations, I think it will be necessary, but hopefully
we'll come on to the teachers in a moment. But as I just referred to there, Alan O'Keefe on page 13 of the Sunday Independent, to wear or not to wear, my journey to find the face mask. And talking about the pressure on bus drivers who are saying, look, we've enough to be doing without making sure people have masks. And he was on a bus yesterday and he came across people who didn't have masks. Just go to some of your texts before we move on to the politics. Hi, Damien. My local pub was full last night when I drove by at 10 o'clock. At least 20 people out in the smoking area. I was shocked to see this. That's in Leitrim. So that's Pat in Leitrim. Kilkee and West Clare was thronged. No social distancing. An average of 10 people in each group. Parents need to take responsibility. We're a small town with only one doctor. That's from Matty. More scaremongering from RTE once again. People have decided to get on with living. We can't stay locked up forever. That's from Con. And I'll read one more. My local in North Cork never had more than 20 people. They can socially distance easy. Dublin will mess it up for the rest of us. Disgraceful, greedy publicans. Grow a pair and take the licence away. That's from Ken in Cork. Thanks for your text on 51551. Well, look, will we stay in Cork, Sheila? Micheál Martin, what an opening week. I was just trying to think there before I came down. I have it scribbled down here. So since this day week, we've had, it's kind of one of these join the dots. What have all these got in common? Dara Cailleary, Michael Moynihan, Willie O'Dea, Jim O'Callaghan, John McGuinness yesterday, Barry Cowan and problems with in the selection of the Gaelic at the Shannon as well. It hasn't been a great start, Sheila, for me.
No, it hasn't
Martin.
Been a great start, really. What a week. I think Hugh O'Connell, his piece in The Independent, sort of tracks the week, for the three of them very well. But there's no doubt about it that it standout has been a pretty rough start for Micheál Martin. And you nearly, when you begin to analyse it, where to begin. But I think undoubtedly where it most certainly started to go wrong was Dara Cailleary, if you like. That was the big one. And I think without over-egging it, he's probably the one that has most... he certainly has the most reason to be justification for being annoyed at being overlooked. He is the deputy leader of the party, and you'd imagine he has the experience and all the qualifications that one would require, notwithstanding the fact that the chief whip is actually a very, very important job and will be a crucial role at this particular time in this government when you've got so many, when you've got the three parties at play. But you can imagine that he is right to feel aggrieved, but the rest of them really can, as far as I'm concerned, join in a long line and jump off the cliff now, to be fair. And just the entitlement and the ego that's involved in taking to Twitter or standing up to journalists and saying that you've been done out of a job is just absolutely appalling. And I think you can see from the reaction that there's been a lot of people throughout the week, absolutely galling to most people that they would think that you are entitled to this. Yeah. Now, that's notwithstanding the fact, obviously, I'm from a rural area and I do understand and believe that geography should play a role in appointing any minister or anybody, you know, and that's what they should, it should be one of the factors. But as anybody who has ever interviewed for a role and chosen a candidate knows, you have to have a number of criteria when you're sitting down to choose a person. And yes, qualifications and experience and skills kind of are part of that. And when it's a minister, you'd have to say the geography comes into play, but it shouldn't be the overarching reason for somebody to get a role. And I say that as somebody from the country. I do understand why, though, we need a voice at the table. Rural people do need a voice at the table. I think Conor Skehan's piece in The Independent is very good on this today. There's a number of pieces kind of allude
Elaine,
to this.
Elaine Byrne also has a good piece in the Business Post as well in relation
where
to
she,
this.
She takes poor James Laffey and the Western people to task as well, you know, for his...
Well, put that in context.
..calls his editorial melodromatic, which is a bit unfair, I think.
So the Western people this week, they said it was a cabinet for Cromwell.
Yeah, well, listen, when you're
evoked
a local
images
paper,
of the Heller to Connacht and all of that sort of stuff.
I'm going to defend...
Dermot Ferder had a bit of a go at that on Friday as well.
Dermot Ferder had his own moment of melodrama, if you ask me, in the Irish Times this week in relation to that. His piece was as melodramatic as the Western people's, if you ask me. I think James Laffey does what all editors and right-thinking local newspapers do in any scenario like this. You don the county jersey. Of course you do.
She's
and you
sticking
are
up for
absolutely
her own here, Larry,
entitled
isn't she?
To throw the toys out of the pram in a scenario like this and outline why people feel that not having a minister is an issue. And that's the bigger issue for me. And that should be the bigger issue for all of us, to be honest, is why do people feel it? They feel that they're being excluded because they see the results. They see that having a minister benefits them, or they believe it does. And, you know, we talked about this yesterday, the day before. Norma Foley, new Minister for Education, one of her first tweets was welcoming funding to a school in Kerry. Underlines the point.
Elaine Byrne, though, in her piece, where she does have a go with the Western people, she does make the point in the last 40 years, Mayo, not the West, Mayo has had 12 senior ministers, 2 chief whips, 12 junior ministers, and not forgetting a Taoiseach.
There's no question about that.
Larry, we might be sitting here saying, God, it's been a terrible week for Micheál Martin. He might be sitting below in Cork South Central saying, I've had a great week. I'm the Taoiseach. I'm the boss. I'm showing everybody that, you know, I make the decisions here.
That's one way to look at it. And I think we need to backpedal a little bit on a couple of things. I think first and foremost, I think Micheál Martin, very few people doubt that he's a decent and sincere person and politician. And I believe he will make a fine Taoiseach. He might look at it and say, and there's truth to this, he had to make decisions. People were going to be let down one way or another. But if we do backpedal for a minute, he has become Taoiseach. The Greens got all the three parties have agreed to this. But Fianna Fáil was in serious trouble. trouble. I mean, their numbers were plummeting. There was internal derision. There was questions, quiet and open, about his leadership. So some of this was always going to come to the top at any stage. But I think that the key thing in terms of the politicians and the noise that they're making, I think that there's a little bit of orchestration going on here. I think in one sense, yes, I think a lot of people are galled that they politicians complaining about not getting ministerial posts.
I thought Willie O'Dea's tweet, for anybody that felt, I genuinely, I'm not just saying this, I thought that that was a parody account when I read the tweet. I thought really in this day and age that you would not tweet what he tweeted.
You're getting to the heart of the matter here. It's a balancing act between politicians, I suppose, their own egotistical disappointment. But on the other hand, what they're saying is my electorate, my constituents, you deserved a minister and you didn't get one. And I'm outraged about that. I'm not outraged for myself. I'm outraged on your behalf. That's really what's going on here. So I think you have a mix of that playing to the home crowd. But on the other hand, and this is the tricky balance, is the amount of people who might say, how dare you? You know, I'm struggling. I'm in the middle of COVID, all this, and you're complaining you didn't get 38 extra grand.
You see, we're unique in this country because I always say because of the GAA structure of the country, within counties you have clubs and within clubs you have parishes and right up and you defend your own. Now, you're a Donegal man, John, but you're also somebody at the head of a teacher union. Do you really care where the Minister for Education is from? Does it make a difference to you and your members?
Absolutely not. We want to get the best quality. Geography doesn't come into it. Geography should not come into it in relation to ministries, in my opinion. That's why you put on the county jersey as a TD. But when you're putting on the green jersey, you're doing it for the country. And there's been too much parish pump over the years, in my opinion. I think the most important thing here is that people are forgetting that there was a lot of frustration within Fianna Fáil for the last 9 years. They were waiting to get in. Every politician wants to be in power. And there were only going to be six positions available, and one of the papers today is talking about how Micheál Martin wanted to hit the ground running in relation to housing and health. And you know, if that was his motivation, like, we'll all support that. So I'm hoping, you know, there will be a reshuffle in 2.5 years. I am disappointed, I suppose, that there was a swede from the top of Donegal to South Limerick who
have
a minister.
Now you see, it doesn't make an ounce of difference.
I am disappointed because
we feel left out. Well, they've forgotten about us.
It's because of those million people who live in that area that.
Does it make a difference where the minister is from, though, to
over
those
the
million
years,
people?
In Irish politics, gender hasn't been featured as much as it should. And I did notice, actually, one of the big issues with this particular parliament is how young the ministers are. And I think that's very, very important. With young people have suffered so much over the last decade and looking into another recession. So, you know, he got a lot of things right, as did Leo and Damon Ryan, but I feel for that swathe of the country, and I think it'll actually work well in their favour, because there was such a furore over this that this government will not be able to neglect rural Ireland because there's been so much noise made about it.
There's been a lot of statements to the effect that it has to be the best person for the job and all that sort of thing. The reality is geography does matter. It does matter to have, I suppose, all regions of the country represented at the table. Whether you think it should or shouldn't on the merits, that's a different question. But the reality is it does matter. It does matter to have people whose first and foremost instinct is their locality, their region, and to be represented across the table. I think it's fundamentally important.
Sheena?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that. Of course I do. You know, and the reality is that people see on the ground that it makes a difference to have a minister in the region. But there's certainly, you'd have to say, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you want the best person in the job in the ministry. Of course you do. And I feel for ministers in lots of ways when they are appointed, because there's still that weight of expectation on home ground to deliver. And that weight of expectation is quite unrealistic. And you cannot have those dual roles. Really, a minister should be allowed nearly to appoint a sort of an aide-de-camp, if you like, but a surrogate, if you like, in their area to sort of represent them when they're gone, you know, and that can be the county councillors.
Exactly. But I think, is this more of a rural phenomenon? Like, I live in Dublin West. And I'd say if you go out there and say, how many ministers do we have? Like, we have an ex-Taoiseach now, junior minister and a senior minister. So you've Roger O'Gorman, Leo Varadkar and Jack Chambers. You're in Wicklow, below in Greystones, in one small seaside town, not so small anymore, two ministers, and Cork South Central, three ministers. But I'm just wondering, are they, you know, I didn't see any bonfires in Castleknock or hear about them in Greystones or below in Cork South Central.
I suppose in rural areas there's that there's a sense of the importance of having the voice at the table, because there's this belief that rural areas aren't looked after as well. Throughout the years, and that's part of that is to do with the centralised nature of the government we have, which is alluded to in a couple of pieces today in the papers, that we need more devolution, if you like, to local government, more powers for local councillors, less form filling, as alluded to in one of the pieces in the papers there about kind of the councillors. Spend, that's the piece in the Business Post from Michael Brennan. He's talking about Sarah Moorhead's, the barrister, her report and the work that county councillors do. They spent more time worrying about form filling and planning applications for constituents, even though they've no influence over these areas. So the whole sector, that whole area of local government needs to be totally and utterly reformed. More powers for the local authorities and for the and for local government. And then once a minister, once a TD is appointed or elected, that they're kind of removed from that. But the reality is there's still, in many cases, those backbenchers are essentially doing the work of jumped up county councillors, to be honest.
She is right in terms of the systemic reforms that she's talking about there. That's absolutely true. But the reality is the geographic spread matters because people think it matters. And that's the name of the game in politics.
Okay, I have a great text in here. Bear with me. And it comes, I'll give credit at the beginning. Louise O'Dowd, who texts in a 51551. Donegal elected an independent. Sligo Leitrim elected an independent. Roscommon Galway elected two independents. Galway West elected two independents. Galway East elected one independent. Clare elected one independent. Tipperary elected one independent. Limerick County elected one independent. Kerry elected two independents. We know who they are. West Cork elected one independent. Waterford elected one independent. Wexford elected one independent. Where were the cabinet ministries to come from? People made their choices. Why complain now? So you can go and put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, you're welcome back to the programme with myself, Damien O'Reilly, here instead of Brendan O'Connor. With me in studio still, I have Larry Donnelly, lecturer of law at NUI Galway and columnist with the journal.ie, Sheila Riley, head of digital at Iconic News, and John Boyle, INTO General Secretary and former principal of St. Columbkills Junior National School in Knocklyon. So, John, I will actually go to you first this time round in relation to the other big question facing us. We talked about opening of pubs, cinemas, restaurants earlier, and people saying, you know, if we're going to do that, well, why can't we reopen the schools? And yet again, this week we hear that there's going to be staggered opening. Maybe they won't open fully. Social distancing will be a problem. There are a few articles in the papers today. The one that stands out for me is Brenda Power. It's very strong on this in the Sunday Times. Her piece, the headline, Teachers' Unions Can't Lecture Us on COVID. And just to paraphrase what she's saying in the first paragraph, if classrooms are empty, then so should the pay packets of teachers.
Well, first of all, it's very unlikely that any classroom is going to be empty. I mean, I've spent the last 6 weeks and expect not to take any holiday other than an odd weekend between now and September, working closely with the parents' groups. And, you know, Brenda Power is castigating teachers and teachers' unions. She says that essentially that we have decided that education is not an essential service. I wish that she were a fly on the wall at the meetings that I've attended this week alone. Three more scheduled for next week between all the partners. The minister came to a meeting, second day in office, and her vision and our vision is a shared vision to reopen schools to the maximum possible. I feel myself in primary education, even though it's been so underfunded down the years, that we will get schools fully reopened. We may have to be a bit creative around the really, really big classes. We cannot have 42 children in a small classroom. But, I mean, some schools have a bit of space that they can work around that. But I was very disappointed because, you know, we're hearing about being sensible and responsible and safe. And, you know, what Brenda wrote, it's easy to sit in your sitting room for the
weekend.
Yeah, but
are you saying that everybody else, the hairdressers in this country, the publicans, the restaurant owners, the shopkeepers, the retailers, that they don't have safety in mind when they've been trying to reopen and deal with unknown numbers coming in, people they don't know? coming in to their shops and to their premises over the last few weeks?
Well, as it happens, two of my sisters have salons in West Donegal, and you know, they know their customers pretty well, and they had so much planning and training to do.
So why not schools?
To take one or two people into the salon at a time. We're bringing a million people back into education in September, and to plan for that million people to have them back safely, we've been following public health advice from the beginning, and public health advice may change over the summer, depending on how this curve is continues to be flattened, please God. But from our point of view, we will have schools reopened with the proper funding in place.
But
I'm more worried about afterwards.
Are you worried about the pupils, or are the teachers worried about themselves?
The teachers are so worried about their pupils. That's why, for example, over 10,000 of our members have signed up to do the July provision and the special JESH programmes this summer. That's why they travelled around the country delivering meals in JESH areas while schools were closed over Easter. We're particularly worried about the vulnerable children. But they're also worried, let's be fair about it, going in for 5 hours in a small classroom with 30 children, and maybe more importantly, in the primary sector, we would have at least 30 parents turning up and maybe siblings. But so it won't be the same, but I feel schools will be open, but they will be much safer places maybe than they ever were in the past.
Okay, and I know this is going to get the backs of teachers up, but it has been said, and I may have read it somewhere as well today in some of the articles as well. And it is, if teachers were on the COVID payment, would the thinking be an awful lot different?
Well, the thinking from some teachers who were on the COVID payment, the substitute teachers who had no work since early March and were on the COVID, and in some cases didn't qualify.
Oh, no, but I'm talking about the full-time teachers.
For the general teaching body, they have worked tirelessly reaching out to children with no broadband available. I see an article now that the broadband is going to be speeded up now in Ireland. And in some cases, they went round to people's homes. So from here on in, my bigger worry, actually, Damien, is not about the reopening of the schools at all. It's about the second wave, and if people are mandated not to go to work, or if children are going to be at home, how are we going to look after them, and how are we going to keep schools open if we don't have substitute teachers to cover for those who are mandated to stay out?
Okay, Sheila and Larry, you both have primary school going children, so Sheila, you first. As a parent, as somebody that has to hold down a day job as well with a youngster at home,
8-year-old, it's extraordinarily difficult, and I think the uncertainty is a big part of the problem, you know. This is kind of alluded to in the piece that Claire Scott has in the Mail today, where she's quoting the Sinn Féin education spokesman, Donal O'Leary, you know, in relation to the kind of the drip nature of how details are being fed in relation to it. I do understand that a lot of this is on the hoof, and that you can't formulate an entire policy for it overnight, but the reality is it's very important that schools get back open.
Do you understand the teachers' concerns?
I totally understand. Absolutely understand where the teachers come from. I think it's very unfortunate the way the teachers have been targeted, and there's a danger that they're going to become the bad guys in relation to this, when that's not really the reality. The reality is that we need all the stakeholders to come together, the teachers, parents and the government, to come together and to work out an actual way of making this work. And I think what's been lacking in this discussion so far has been creative thinking. You know, how are we going to think outside the box? You know, are there ways of using other spaces in parishes? Are there ways that the staggered time can see morning or afternoon teaching for, say, young children in particular? Would teachers be willing to work extra hours in that case, where that's a scenario? I just think we've been lacking that creative thinking, to be honest.
Yeah, I really think that some of the teacher bashing, for lack of a better way of putting it, has been really unfortunate. I have two cousins in Galway who are teachers. One of them is married to a Roscommon teacher. I'm a teacher myself. So I think that's unfortunate. That having been said, as you know, a parent, I can attest to one reality, and then I can say something that I think most parents are thinking. The one reality is that if you think that among young children social distancing is happening, you are wrong. There is no social distancing whatsoever on my street or on most streets that I can see around the country. It's just so unnatural. It was going to break down at one point in time. The second thing is, really, we have to go back in September. I'm deeply worried about Larry Ogue. If we could get half an hour a day, I see these super parents who have their kids doing all sorts of things. God bless them. If we could get Larry Ogue to do half an hour of work a day, it was a good day. And I worry about his progress and his formation. He's seven. We got to go back in September. Creative ways, as Sheila says, but we got to go back.
When you say that, you're worried, in what respect? Like reading, for example, at that age is very important, teachers will tell you. Do you worry that he may have regressed over the last few months?
I do. I worry about both academic development and personal development as well. I think this is a really, really important time for a seven-year-old, and I worry deeply that, you know, things could fall back, and I think that's why September has to happen.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the personal development issue is a bigger one for me, really. And, you know, I would be concerned about kind of the effects on mental health of children, you know, and we live in a rural area, so we're not seeing kids on the street, you know, that's the reality of it. Yeah. You know, I've had a little fella at home with his three-year-old sister for 4 months.
And can't visit granny, all of that.
Yeah, you're talking across the garden to granny, you know, it's just, that element I feel hasn't been properly addressed or catered for. And to be honest, I kind of think the lack of direction that's been coming from the schools in relation to it has been really, really disappointing on that aspect of it alone. I think that schools should have done more in relation to catering and looking after for kids in that area, like things like Zoom sessions and stuff like that. Like I organised a Zoom call with my my son and his mates over a number of weeks, and that like was just like 40 minute call a week, but it seemed to be a big benefit to them, and they enjoyed that. And I think on a school level, if things were done on a different level, you know, in schools, that would have helped an awful lot. I think that's a bigger issue, to be honest, for me.
I just see here, just that I'll reference to it, and I just want to read a few comments, and John, I'll come back to you then. Edgar Mongeroth in the Sunday Times also has a piece here where he says, follow the lessons of more agile countries and we'll be fitter for the coronavirus fight. He's saying, like, we've known for the same length of time as a lot of other countries about how to try and get back. Can we look at how this is working in other countries is the theme of his piece. A very interesting piece. And I don't think reading that and looking at some of the texts I'm going to read now, or indeed this email, that people are pointing the fingers necessarily, as you say, Larry, at the teachers. People do have sympathy in general. It's more at the policymakers that the we're hearing about. Like, I'm a primary school teacher in Cork. The teachers are not the problem. As a school, we've had a number of Zoom meetings since early June to plan for the reopening of our school in September. We've been trying to do this without any direction from the department. It issues guidelines that are very ambiguous in a number of areas, and therein lies the issue. Therefore, we will continue to have meetings throughout the summer break. Teachers cannot wait to get back to school in September. All we want is that it's a safe environment for our children and a safe workplace for teachers. We need clarification from the department. A couple of other another text here. Teachers are going back at the end of August. They shouldn't be taking the blame or scapegoated for Department of Education policies that have created schools with 30 plus children in classes without hot water for proper hand washing. That's a point from Michael in Limerick. A few more here. If I go through them, well, there's lots here. One more. Teachers are going back at the end of August. Yeah, I have that one. Sorry. I wanted to go to one of the shorter ones because there's quite a lot of long ones here. But they are generally, John, saying that it is government policy, years of neglect, you know, in terms of the pupil-teacher ratio, is now coming back to bite us. Is that a fair enough charge?
Absolutely. I mean, if only they had been listening for the last decade. We started out at the beginning of the decade with 30-31 in every single class. We still have 20% of the children in classes over 30. So when I mentioned earlier that I'm worried about the schools remaining open, I'm really worried about if that class's teacher, that massive class, if the teacher's absent, we cannot have that class split amongst the remaining classes, because the whole concept of the bubbles and the pods will fall down. So we've have stimulus packages for all areas of the economy. When you're getting a million people back into education, the government are going to have to fund to make sure that they go back safely. I have to say that in general, you know, teachers have really stepped up to the plate over the recent months. And if people are concerned about a lack of planning for September, the reason for that is because this is the first week of July. And I can assure you that the work that we're doing with parents' bodies and with the department officials will make sure that there is a proper plan in place. The query I have is, will it be funded? But we won't be going back because we won't have a plan. There will be a detailed plan available to schools in August. And at that point, I think that certainly in the primary sector, the vast majority of children will go back exactly the way they left in their class.
I totally accept what you're saying there, John, but I think for a lot of parents listening this morning, August, hearing about a plan in August is kind of too late for them. They really need to know sooner rather than later what is going to be the story for them in September. Now, I do not ascribe to the notion that teachers are babysitters. I do not believe that at all. That's not what I'm saying. But people do need to know what's going to happen, because it's very hard to turn around to an employer in mid-August or late August and say to them, oh, look, as it turns out now, my child is not going to get in until X amount of hours a day. I won't be available for that period of time.
In the primary school, they'll be back for every hour of the day, except in maybe the very vulnerable children. So I can assure you that that is the intention of everybody around those tables.
All right, last word to you on this, Larry.
Sheila's point is well made and understandable, but the fact is it is immensely difficult to predict what we're going to be able to do or not do in September. At the university level, I'm involved in a committee in the law school and NUIG trying to sort this out. It's very, very difficult to make a call.
Okay. We're going to move on because I have on the line Eddie Brennan, Laois hurling manager, former multiple All-Ireland winner with Kilkenny, RT Sunday Game pundit, and God, he's so many strings to his bow, and even involved at club level there. So stick on your headphones there. Eddie, good morning to you.
Good morning, folks. How are you?
We're talking here about schools reopening, but to an extent, a lot of youngsters are back mingling once again now, thanks to the reopening of GA clubs and other sports clubs. I believe you welcomed the under-9s back yesterday.
Yeah, we did. We got back to the field yesterday with our juveniles, and it was refreshing, I suppose, and even, I suppose, exciting, really, because it was great to see the enjoyment of the kids back interacting with each other again, because obviously they hadn't, we were only kind of initiating or kicking off our plans for the year with the juveniles, and it all came to a grinding halt. And in a way, I suppose it was the social interaction more than anything else, because a lot of them obviously wouldn't have crossed paths at all due to the regulations and due to the fact that they weren't in school. So there was massive excitement, but it was a smaller than normality, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah. And what changes had to be made, Eddie? I believe most clubs now, I don't know, does it extend even further to actual teams, but do you have to have a coronavirus person there? Does each club now have to have as much as you need a PRO and a secretary, you need a coronavirus secretary now as well?
Yeah, what you have is you have safety officers there, and again, look, like all things, the GA, they're volunteers and they're coming in there and they're overseeing that side of it. There's the cleaning of the hands for the kids when they arrive in, and there's filling in your health questionnaires prior to training, so you're making sure that everything so far as possible is in place to limit any form of anything happening. So it's a good thing in a way. It just means that for me anyway, that what I've seen from this is probably we've upped the standards in terms of our, you know, hand hygiene and stuff like that. It's something that maybe we were a little bit casual up to this point. But like I said, the main thing yesterday was just to get the kids all back in together and enjoying a little bit of social interaction.
Yeah, great relief for the children and indeed the parents as well, I suppose. But as we move further up the grades and, you know, it gets more serious in terms of competition right up to senior level, we know the club players obviously are allowed back training. There's been challenge matches taking place and club championships will begin in a couple of weeks' time. But county teams cannot gather together for collective training until September. So we have this club versus county war wound reopened again. You have concerns about the fairness in all of this. Tell me about that, Eddie.
I spoke to Mike Moynihan there in the Irish Examiner there a few weeks ago. Mike contacted me, and I think what it was basically, I think initially, you know, people felt maybe this was going to blow over quickly, and I suppose from the manager's point of view, you're kind of going, well, you don't want to get caught behind everybody else. So in a way, I think there were concerns, you know, there were kind of obviously, you know, I think anyone, you make a decision or you take measures to say, look, you put a plan in place. And but what was happening, look, I think everyone was talking very openly about it, that, you know, teams had continued to train through it. And then I think that really probably escalated over the last few weeks because, you know, the GAA intervened and kind of said, look, there's no county training officially till the 13th of September. And, you know, I think that cranked up. But I think what really caught us all by surprise, in fairness, was that they turned around and said there was going to be no sanctions for it. So for me, in my opinion, that just made a kind of a farcical situation that you're saying, look, lads, there's rules and regulations in place. But don't worry, it's okay. If anyone is caught outside of that, we're not going to punish them. And we can't have a scenario like that. I think in ordinary run of things, maybe you'd say grand, but we're in very, very extraordinary times. We have been for the last four months. So when you put it against the backdrop of that, you say, well, hold on, lads, they're doing the right thing here. There's people's lives at stake. And I think even if you're to... I suppose we've all been monitoring Dr. Tony Houlihan and he's been absolutely brilliant, I think, in terms of leading the charge. And I just think when you see the figures that are coming through in the last couple of weeks, it seems to be that the under 35s now are the ones that are starting to ping in relation to, you know, before it was seen the average was over 80 and 84 years of age. So I think if anything, this the last while, I think it's bigger than the GAA, and obviously the GAA is important in our communities, but it's bigger than that now, because you're saying, well, if we needed a little reminder maybe that this thing isn't going away, then more than ever, look, we're saying now it's the people that we felt weren't getting it are now starting to pick up on it a little bit.
Yeah, and just finally, Eddie, you're a serving guard as well, and so you know what's involved on the front line, and we see that, you know, pound for pound, the best footballer in the country, Jack McCaffrey, stepping away from the Dubs. He works as a medic. As a manager, you know, where are you going to have frontline staff coming to you, or indeed players that are living and caring for vulnerable relations, such as parents, and saying to you, look, Eddie, I can't throw my lot in for the championship this year. Now, in any other given year, you put the arm around the shoulder and try and talk them into, we can do what we can. So what's the attitude going to be like there? And again, is that going to see a lot of unfairness where in clubs and indeed counties where a lot of players, just for health reasons, step away this year and wait until next year?
Yeah, well, I think on that aspect and that very issue, I don't think unfairness will ever come into that. Like, I think the one thing that we do and I have adopted is you respect the individual choices that people make. And, you know, some of the guys, if I'm to say, look, the spectrum of the panel that I have, you know, some have elderly parents, some don't. And, you know, it hasn't been an issue because we just haven't been together and, you know, other than a little bit of Zoom to catch up with lads and that. So in terms of that, I think that's something that, you know, I certainly wouldn't be, you know, and I don't think any manager, club or county will turn around and put someone in a difficult position. But yeah, look, from a frontline perspective, I think people have been excellent up to this point. And I think, you know, the engagement has been really, really good. But like I said there, I think it's now the time is, this is the time where, while we're coming back to a fraction of normality in terms of, you know, getting the GAA pitches open and having that social resource there for people to go and do what they perceive to be, you know, what the normal run of things during the summer. Whereas now you say, well, look, we have to keep our shoulder to the wheel now and keep our eye on the ball, because now is the time not to probably get casual, because I think we could lose everything if we don't mind what we
sure,
have.
Sure, and that was an issue we raised at the top of the program. Lovely to chat to you, Eddie, and the very best of luck to you and Leash, and indeed in your role as a guard over the next few weeks as well. Thanks very much for joining us. Guys, just before 12 o'clock, breaking news, Larry, Kanye's for president.
I don't know what to make of that one, to be honest with you, but anything can happen, as Donald Trump has proven.
Well, and am I hearing rumours that Donald Trump is going to quit while he's behind?
I wouldn't put any stock in that, to be honest with you. I think he will see it out. And again, he's in trouble at the moment. Joe Biden looks like the favourite, but I wouldn't count him out.
Sheila, can you ask for president?
Oh, how alarming. But then, I mean, look who's in there already. It's already alarming enough, to be honest.
I was going to say that.
It fairly puts Micheál Martin's week into perspective.
Yeah, well, anyway, that is the breaking news. Is he going to run as an independent, Larry? Have the nominations for the Republican nomination, have they closed yet? Could he actually run instead of Donald?
No, I don't think that's a possibility. If he runs, fair play to him, but I just don't see it.
Larry, thank you so much for that. Watch this space, as they say. So thanks very much indeed to my panel this morning. Thanks to Eddie Brennan there, Matthew earlier on. So Larry, Sheila and John, thank you all very much,
thank
and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.